are the people who just worked through a pandemic to keep this company alive. They walk into a meeting one day randomly, and they're just fired, and that's it. And they were handed a flyer for an upcoming job fair, and have a nice day.
Black workers receive just 3 job offers to every 4 that were offered to Latinx workers. And then we were documenting not only kind of an initial application, but also follow-up calls were monitored. And we saw that job offers made through these follow-up calls were even more biased in favor of Latinx workers, who received nearly 2 times as many job offers as their Black counterparts.
And you're doing the right decision at the end, which is best for labor unions and the organization, not what my agenda is or someone else's. Well, what's best for the organization?
I'm about to scab your rat and a big fat cat. They won't stop the union folks. Bust the union down. We won't let them do it. No, we won't let them do it. Oh, no.
I think we all agree that snakes are part of the environment and the ecology of the river down there by the Yarra, so you just have to be careful and take the appropriate precautions, but we're not trying to eradicate things.
It seems like things are off to a pretty good start, and it just seems like a good time to try to be a rabble-rouser, you know, in whatever way I can.
Our offices, the next town over, Montpelier, someone dumped, I want to say, about 40 pounds of potassium nitrate on our front step. And there was just like a note taped to the box that said, like, found this while digging fences, heard you guys took dangerous stuff. Like, I mean, we almost called them the bomb squad.
This is not a 1-year thing. This is a 5, 10, 15 year thing that we have to look at. This network went from 20 members who really existed basically as a list to something where we are meeting every week and we're actually doing a lot of stuff together in basically 6 months.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Week Roundup of highlights of some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check them all out at laborradionetwork.org. This week, the Working People Podcast returns to Asheville, North Carolina, where the union-busting No Evil Foods abruptly closed its plant, leaving employees out of work with no severance. Then, on Monday Morning QB, researcher Brittany Scott of Partners for Dignity and Rights talks about their recent research uncovering discrimination in temp worker hiring in Chicago and how to fight back. Next, the Heartland Labor Forum profiles 2 local women leaders, Elise Martini at the Kansas City Building Trades and Tony Robinson, president of the Postal Workers ACMO Local. Then a world premiere of Scabby the Rad and Fatty the Cat, a brand new song we played on this week's Your Rights at Work radio show here in Washington, D.C. From Australia, we'll hear about the Collingwood Community Gardeners being locked out of their garden on the Solidarity Breakfast podcast. And on the SAG-AFTRA podcast, Foo Fighters guitarist Chris Shiflett talks about his big break and his support for the labor movement. We wrap up this week's show with a pair of profiles. Mike Peabody talks about how he learned his trade as a garbage man on the America Works podcast. And you'll get a look inside the Labor Radio Podcast Network in the first of a series of profiles put together by network producer Evan Papp. Evan's been conducting these interviews of network members over the last year and will be featuring them in upcoming editions of The Weekly. I'm Chris Garlock for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Remember, you can find all of today's shows along with more than 100 more just like them at laborradionetwork.org. And if you enjoy the Labor Radio Podcast Network Weekly, please be sure to like us and share. Solidarity works. Here's the show.
right. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Working People, a podcast about the lives, jobs, dreams, and struggles of the working class today. Now, if you've been listening to the show for a little while, then you'll probably remember an episode that we published last August, in which I interviewed four former employees of No Evil Foods, a vegan meat company founded in North Carolina. Now, that episode ended up getting a lot of attention for a number of reasons. It got attention because we played over 8 minutes of truly blood-boiling recordings from the union-busting captive audience meetings that management at No Evil Foods subjected their workers to when they learned about a unionization drive on the shop floor. It got attention because No Evil Foods waged a truly scummy campaign to censor us and get the episode taken down. I don't say any of this lightly. I say it because of the terrible, infuriating, and despicably unsurprising news that prompted today's important follow-up to our last episode on No Evil Foods. And I'll let Paul Blessed at Discourse Blog describe it to you. Quote, No Evil Foods, a North Carolina-based company that makes vegan meat substitutes, laid off the entire production team and shuttered their production near Asheville last week. At the time, No Evil portrayed the layoffs as necessary in order to ensure the company had a future. In today's episode, I got to chat with John Reynolds and Megan Sullivan, two former No Evil Foods employees who also joined us on the last episode, and I'm super, super grateful to them for coming back on and for all the work that they are doing trying to raise awareness and trying to raise funds for the laid-off employees. And so I wanted to ask if you guys could talk to listeners and give us a bit of an update on the latest development from the quote-unquote No Evil company.
Yeah, earlier this year, maybe March, April, in that ballpark, I started getting messages from people at No Evil Foods who were being fired and or laid off for, you know, whatever reason. What made it interesting is that it wasn't just one or two people. Like, these firings would happen 3, 4, 5 firings at a time, or in like clusters. There were like these random, quote unquote, random cluster firings that were happening over the last few months and leading up to June of this year. And we're talking people who stood by the company throughout the union drive, who stood by them throughout the pandemic, people just getting canned. And for me and for them, we were speculating back and forth. Is this company going out of business? Are they moving more to automation? Like, what the hell's going on? And this past June 11th, I was suddenly contacted by an onslaught of employees who said that they were just laid off. The company had called a meeting. They would be paid through the day, they were told, and their health benefits would be cut. And that would be it. They were just laid off that day. And there was no warning leading up to this. And that was it. These are the people who had just worked through a pandemic to keep this company alive. They walk into a meeting one day randomly, and they're just fired. And that's it. And they were handed a flyer for an upcoming job fair and have a nice day. Thanks for your service.
If I recall correctly, No Evil Foods actually gave workers a bit of an ultimatum during the pandemic, saying that they could either show up to work and, like, basically they had to have perfect attendance and they would get their version of the quote unquote hero pay for showing up to work during a deadly pandemic, or they could leave and get a tiny, like, severance package, but they would not be able to return to their jobs after the pandemic was over. Or the third option was they could leave with no severance, but they would have the option of coming back to work when it was safe to do so, right? And I think that No Evil Foods basically gave employees like 24 hours to make a decision about that. Am I right about that?
Yeah, essentially. And it's really funny. I haven't really had a chance to talk on a lot of these outlets about the actual climate that existed right as COVID kicked off, because granted, we had just gone through that union drive, which was really divisive. And we've covered that one. Like it was exhausting. It was terrible for everybody involved, regardless of what side they fell on. And so now you get into this like hearing of a global pandemic, and all of a sudden you can't find toilet paper at the grocery store, and they can't afford masks, even in the facility, which in some of the rooms, like you needed an actual mask because of all the dust that accumulates in the air from all the dry goods and dry ingredients. And so we're running short on supplies, gloves too. We're running short on supplies. Everybody's really like concerned and confused, because at that point, nobody really knew a whole lot about COVID, how it spread and all of that. And meanwhile, you have the upper management and employers telling everybody that, oh, no, you don't have to be here if you don't want to be. Work is the safest place you can be. I'm the manager here, and I feel safer here at this facility than I do in my own car. And it just like word for word. Word, by the way, is some of this stuff was being said. And it really allowed us to continue organizing, as sad as that sound. I would have liked to be organizing under better circumstances. It, in a way, brought everybody back together with that petition, because yes, they gave us those three options. And one thing that's worth noting as well is that with that third option, where they got you pick this option, you get 3 weeks of severance pay, you're never allowed to return back to the company. But in addition to that, in order to get that 3 weeks of severance, you had to sign an NDA, which conveniently for them included that you basically don't hold no evil at fault for any alleged violation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the NLRA. I believe the NLRA was mentioned twice in that NDA, that they definitely weren't responsible for any violation of it. It adds insult to injury that the only way that these people, some of whom were immunocompromised and some of whom have immunocompromised or high-risk children, they didn't really have a choice. They had to leave. And in order to get any kind of severance, they had to basically sign something that said they're not allowed to talk about anything that happened. And that in itself is suspect. So again, that really allowed us to have that petition for immediate hazard pay be successful, because the true colors were coming out. Because during a union drive, when your managers are trying to convince you not to unionize, they put on this facade of, oh no, we love all of you, you guys are our family. And then all of a sudden, the drop of a hat, when there's real risks involved with working there, the mask comes off and they're just like, well, you know, you don't have to be here. It's just, you don't say that to people who are your family.
This is Monday Morning QB, June 21st, 2021. I'm Askia Muhammad. Our final story this morning takes us to Chicago, where temp workers have long accused bosses of blatant discrimination and retaliation. New research confirms this reality and presents opportunities to heal the racial schism built by employers. Chris Banger-Drowns reports.
Brittany Scott is a senior research strategist at Partners for Dignity and Rights, an advocacy organization devoted to advancing economic and social rights. Recent research she authored in collaboration with the Equal Rights Center has made concrete what Chicago temp workers already know too well. Black workers are turned away from jobs at disproportionate rates, and workers who do find jobs are exploited. But what makes this research novel isn't its findings, but rather the data collection process itself. Brittany Scott's study used a tactic called matched pairs testing, where volunteers of different races are paired up so that age, work history, and other non-racial characteristics are virtually indistinguishable. The pairs then go to temp hiring centers looking for work and compare experiences.
Our matched pairs were with one Black job applicant and one Latinx job applicant. And we did that for a couple of reasons. members of these groups make up most of the people applying for jobs in this industry, over 80% in the Chicago area. And there's just been a mounting abundance of anecdotal evidence. There's been investigative journalism and some litigation popping up over the last few years that really suggests that staff agencies are engaging in racial discrimination.
Will Evans, a journalist with the Center for Investigative Reporting, wrote in 2016 about how temp agencies use explicitly racist language, as well as barely coded words, to communicate with client companies about their workforce needs. Some agencies simply use numbers to designate racial identity, with Latinx workers referred to as Code 3, for example.
They're also doing it in terms of gender. They're asking for heavy ones or light ones, meaning men or women. And all of this, you know, what we've found limits Black workers' access to jobs. And it's also, we think, an exercise in an unlawful preference for Latinx workers that they perceive to be more vulnerable due to perception of likely undocumented immigration status.
Brittany Scott's research reveals more about the racial discrimination uncovered by Will Evans' reporting.
Black workers received just 3 job offers to every 4 that were offered to Latinx workers. And then we were documenting not only kind of an initial application, but also follow-up calls were monitored. And we saw that job offers made through these follow-up calls were even more biased in favor of Latinx workers, who received nearly 2 times as many job offers as their Black counterparts. The only jobs that were offered to our Black testers at an equal or higher rate were the lowest paying jobs and second and third shifts at factories.
But this certainly doesn't mean Latinx workers have it easy.
At the same time, right, Latinx workers are being sought out for what other studies have certainly exposed as exploitation in the workplace. There's very dangerous working conditions at sub-minimum wages. I would say these are sweatshops. You know, at one point, the Department of Labor define modern day sweatshops as having 2 or more violations of some basic labor standards. And I would say that's absolutely what we're seeing in these types of workplaces.
Brittany Scott says a culture of discrimination and retaliation means enforcement of labor protections for temp workers is extremely difficult. But there are some proposed solutions. One mentioned in the research is a temp agency seal of approval program, which would create incentives for companies that use temp labor to agree to basic standards.
And so the seal of approval program is really learning from what workers are doing in other industries in this kind of modern day supply chain. And so I'm talking about the proven effective enforcement model where we see power being shifted between workers and the companies at the top of supply chains.
Examples of this kind of enforcement organizing include the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and the Bangladesh Accord for Fire and Building Safety.
Similar to these established programs, the Seal of Approval Program seeks to create market incentives for temp agency compliance by winning legally binding agreements with the biggest buyers of the brands that temps in Chicago are producing, moving, and packing. In them, a brand name company or perhaps a public institution that's buying these products would agree to only produce or warehouse these products in factories and warehouses that agree to only use temp agencies that participate in the Seal of Approval program.
That's Brittany Scott, Senior Research Strategist at Partners for Dignity and Rights. For Monday Morning QB, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns.
You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Once again, I'm Judy Ansel. When you think of labor leaders, think women. This week, or tonight, on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll profile local women union leaders. Elise Martini leads the KC Building Trades. She's making sure the airport gets done right. She also knows firsthand the challenges women in construction face on the job.
I am Tom Gepkin, president of CWA Local 6360, and I will be co-hosting tonight's show with Judy Morgan, former state rep and former president of AFT Local 691. The Kansas City Building and Trades Council is the backbone of the construction industry. Leading this council is Elise Martini. She has been in the construction industry for over 40 years. Her construction camp program introduces the construction field to women as a viable career. We want to welcome you to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Well, thank you, Tom and Judy. I'm excited to be here.
So, Elise, you're a woman in a predominantly men's field. I was wondering, how did you overcome all the obstacles that might have been put in your way as an apprentice and then later on as a journey person?
So I will be honest, I have overcome obstacles, and every woman does, all the way until probably 15 years ago when I finally earned the respect of working my butt off, because it's really important. And women and minorities, we have to work half as hard to be twice as good in some aspects of it, especially when you're first getting started. When somebody pulls up on the job site, especially finishing concrete, and you've been working 6 hours and you finally get a break, and everybody's sitting having a sandwich, and you're sitting there with them, they recognize that man or that minority, that female, and like, why aren't you working? And it's like, everyone has to support each other, and there is a lot more support now than there ever was. But in 1980 through 2000, maybe 2005, it's really difficult, and it's still difficult for a lot of brand new folks. We're dealing with that at the airport.
Do you think you were accepted, or did you experience any difficulties along the way? You've talked about that, but also including in your current position as business manager of the Greater Kansas City Building and Construction Trades. It seems to me like you'd have to be a pretty strong woman to get to where you're at right now.
So it's very political. You have to know your delegate strength, and you have to. I've been elected now on my third term, and I knew. But I worked with all these folks. So when you work with all these folks, and I have an agenda, I want to see more women delegates. I want to see more minorities. So the folks that are the business managers and elected officials and agents I worked with, so they have a lot of respect for me, and that helps a lot. But I had to earn that respect. And earning that respect means it's that, you know, all of us work a 24/7 job. I mean, the phone rings on Friday night to Sunday, and we take those calls, as well as it's political. You have to be able to make sure you can't please everybody, but you have to do your best as far as making sure everyone's opinion is heard and you're doing the right decision at the end, which is best for labor unions and the organization, not what my agenda is or someone else's. Well, what's best for the organization?
So you did talk about recruiting minorities, and you think that's an important thing to do. So talk about that in terms of minorities and women in the construction trades.
It is huge. And thanks to a agreement we have with the CWC and the KCI Airport, we are meeting and matching those goals there. And we have got right now about 80 new minority and females working on that project. So when you look at what we have at the airport, we can definitely move that forward to other projects. Like the one thing that's different from me and my predecessors is we've actually got community benefit agreements that say, we're going to make sure unions are recognized on this job. That's what we did with the airport. That's what we did at the Downtown Convention Hotel. And I want to see that on Jacks County Detention Center. I want to see that on the Great Plains Tech Center up north. There are so many opportunities that we can bring more men and women in. And there's a crisis right now. There are so many great opportunities, and these are great paying jobs.
Well, Elise, Judy, and I want to thank you for coming on the Heartland Labor Forum and giving us the insight into yourself and to the building trades in Kansas City. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. And I got to thank you and Judy, because it takes volunteers like yourself that makes KKFI so valuable to all of us. And I appreciate you guys' time and all the hard work you do to make it such a success. These are great programs.
Thank you. We enjoy doing it.
The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to our engineer tonight, Jen Zaman. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special, which is Stand Up. It's a roundtable on policing in Kansas City.
This is a public service announcement with guitar. Number
Welcome to Your Rights at Work with me, Chris Garlock, and Ed Smith. We're back. We're live. And this is a show about your rights on the job, the ones you have, the ones you don't have, the ones you wish you had. You can call us your questions about worker rights, 202-588-0893. You can tweet us your questions at DC Labor. No questions too big or too small. We are a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, over 100 shows just like this across the country. You can check them out at laborradionetwork.org. On today's shows, we have a ton of labor news to discuss, including the Teamsters say they're going to organize Amazon, and Barbara Krieger from NABIT Local 31 is going to talk about workers under assault at Montgomery Community Television. And Nikki Cole is going to preview tonight's panel on wages, benefits, and fair pay. 20 years at DC Jobs with Justice. Ed, nobody has heard this song ever before. And that's because the genesis of it was that a couple of weeks ago, we ran a story on a demonstration that was happening up Strathmore Music. I think we talked about it on this show, Ed Smith. And I helped them to get Big Inflatable Rat, Big Inflatable Cat to put out in front of Strathmore to sort of make the point about the bad stuff that's going on there and how they're treating their workers. And one of our readers in Union City turns out to be a member of the musicians union in, I think it's Cleveland, if I'm not mistaken, and wrote a song. And took him a couple of weeks to actually, you'll appreciate this as a musician, Ed. I was like, right away, I was like, he sent me the lyrics. I was like, I love the lyrics. Where's the song? He's like, yeah, I'm working on it. And
what have you done for me lately, Chris?
I know, right? Exactly. So, Kalia, let's give this, let's do a world premiere of Scabby the Rat and Fatty the Cat. Here it is.
Now listen up, people. I'm gonna talk you some about some nasty creatures wanna do what's wrong about a scabby old rat and a big fat cat. They wanna starve the union folks, bust the union down. We won't let them do it. No, no, we won't let them do it. No, no, we're gonna put those major beasts back in the dump where they belong. Use your cats and rats, I don't get along. But these two are tight, yeah, just like Cheech and Chong. But they're not making jokes, they're serious as can be. Doing all they can to bring our solidarity. We won't let them do it, no, no, we won't let them do it. No, no, we're gonna put the major beasts back in the dump where they belong. A fat cat feeds Scabby, it'll make him strong. Gives him spies and consultants to do the work is wrong. But now we've got Scabby's number, we answer to that call. It says, injury to one, why it's an injury to all. We won't let him do it, no, no, we won't let him do it. No, no, we're gonna put those mangy beasts back in the dump where they belong. So bye-bye, Scabby. So long, fat cat. See you later, alligators. Hit the road, Jack. Reprehensible rodent. Fat, so feline. Time to pack your bags. Head on down the line. You ain't staying here. Time for you to go. You ain't staying here. Time to hit the road. You'd better go, 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 go. Get the hell on out of here.
All right, all right, all right. That is Scabby the Rat and Fatty the Cat. Todd Smith, he's Vice President of Musicians Local 4 out of Cleveland, Ohio. Ed Smith, let me get your critical reaction, brother.
Kudos, kudos, kudos. Fun recording, a little bluesy, almost a little New Orleans sound, great vocals, fun guitar playing, and certainly very funny and cool lyrics. I give it two thumbs up.
Two thumbs up. I'm with you. That's four thumbs from your right to work. Chris Garlick, of course, here with Ed Smith. And oh, we got a bingo bell. Two thumbs up and a bingo bell. All right. That is going to do it for this week's edition of Your Rights at Work. Hope you enjoyed it. Tune in next week, same time, same station. Thanks to Mike Nasella. Thanks to Kalia for engineering. Everybody continue to be safe out there wherever you are. And we will see you all next week. All good right. To see you, Ed.
Peace and love and solidarity.
This is a public service announcement with guitar.
Welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR 8:55 a.m. streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand, and of course the website solidaritybreakfast.org.
You're with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're moving on to a look at what's going on at the community Collingwood Community Gardeners plot down by the Yarra near the Collingwood Children's Farm. And we've got Giles on the line. G'day, Giles. How are you?
Hi, Annie. How are you going? Thanks for having me.
Oh, good. I'm glad to talk to you about this. This is really serious business. Not last week, but the week before, I think it was, the plotters, the Collingwood gardeners from the community gardens were told that a external consultant's report found that there were unacceptable risks of visitors being bitten by snakes and impaled by star pickets, and you were all locked out.
Yeah, it was completely unexpected, and it was delivered via a lockdown Zoom meeting from the Committee of Management, and the plotters weren't able to even talk to each other in that Zoom meeting or respond to the statement read out by the Committee of Management about their decision to close the plots indefinitely. We're still wondering what's actually going on, because we know there's definitely some safety issues that need to be addressed in the plots, and there are always things that need cleaning up and maintaining, obviously, in the garden. So the only way that can happen is if we have access to the gardens and we can do some working bees or, you know, do some necessary repairs and so on. But at the moment, it looks like we're being indefinitely locked out, and we've tried to reinstate access this week by meeting with the farm, the manager, Connor Hickey, and communicating discontent to anyone who will listen, really. But it's been to no avail so far, and we've been told that we won't be able to access our plots anytime soon.
There's 70 plots, 100 people involved. It's 42 years old, this garden. And Stephen Jolly, who's a councillor at Yarra Council, ran a Zoom last Sunday around this particular issue. And the safety issues seem to be spurious, don't they?
Yeah, look, Steve Jolly's been great. He's been involved in a number of different meetings this week with us, the plotters, who are trying to campaign to reinstate access to the plots and to stop any planned redevelopment that seems to be on the agenda from the farm. The safety issues are definitely there, like I said, and we're willing to...
I don't mean it like that. I mean that they're managing.
Exactly, and we don't want to get rid of snakes. I think we all agree that snakes are a part of the environment and the ecology of the river down there by the Yarra, so you just have to be careful and take the appropriate precautions, but we're not trying to eradicate things, or we can definitely work with the farm as it has been for the last 42 years.
Yeah, but Stephen was talking about, like, he actually had been quite proactive. He'd spoken to the CFMEU and yep. some other unions, and they had said that they were quite happy to come and have a look and give free labour to fixing any paths or any of the other things that were at issue.
Yeah, that's and it's great to have that kind of offer from the CFMEU, and I've spoken to them during the week, and we've organised to have a site visit on Tuesday at 10 a.m. to have a walk through and look at what the issues are that need addressing immediately. But we've communicated that to the Committee of Management and to the farm to say that the CFMEU is willing to help address this issue as a matter of urgency, and they've denied that from us and are saying they won't even allow us access to walk through and see what needs to be fixed.
Now, the efficacy for the community of people who actually work in the plots is undoubtable. Yeah. It's undoubtable. Not only does it yeah. put food on people's tables, but it actually alleviates mental stress, doesn't it?
Exactly. And personally, I'd have to say that the ability for me to walk down to the plots a couple of times a week and do some gardening and getting in amongst the roots has really been something that helps me get through the working week. And it's not simply about growing food, although it is for a large part about the produce that people are able to grow themselves. It's also about the ability to spend some time in amongst the weeds and the plants and organising a little plot of soil that really means a lot to people. And I've seen this in the faces of the potters who are my neighbours and who I've seen online during the week in lockdown now, meetings, and it's really taking a toll on people.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but now one of the basic principles of having a plot is that you don't have any backyard. You have no other way of interacting, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we have people who, you know, don't live on, say, the ground floor. They don't have any garden access in their place of residence. And part of the way that the plots have been prioritised is for people who are residents of Yarra and who don't have access to gardening in their own home. And so a majority of the plotters, I would say, don't have any other garden access where they live in the city. And as we know, there's increasing numbers of high-rise residential towers going up in the council area, and so access to green space and to space where you can, you know, do some of this kind of gardening for food, but also for your mental health is really important.
Thank you very much, Giles. Good luck.
All right. Thanks for your time, Annie.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gabrielle Carteris, president of SAG-AFTRA.
And I'm David White, National Executive Director of SAG-AFTRA.
Welcome to the SAG-AFTRA podcast. You know, if you're a Foo Fighters fan like me, or just a music fan in general, you will love the work of our special guest, Chris Shiflett. Chris is the lead guitarist for the rock band Foo Fighters, which he joined in 1999.
Chris is one of the great guitarists of his generation, and he's also, thankfully, an active union member. Mm-hmm. He's passionate about the role of SAG-AFTRA in musicians' careers and lives, and we're going to have a chance to talk with him about that and plenty of other topics during this interview.
Yes, Chris, we're excited.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Before we started the podcast, you were talking about the new album from Foo Fighters. Were you recording it during the COVID period?
No, it's like we finished literally right before COVID. COVID, I think, was already happening, but it was like we finished it January of last year. And we were just getting ready to start rehearsing to get ready to go out on tour. And yeah, all that kind of fell by the wayside. So, but I remember that conversation of like, do you think this COVID thing's really going to cancel everything? Like, is that possible? And then, you know, sure enough, here we are.
Does all the new technology help, like the streaming and the ability to be in different locations while you're recording?
I mean, it's going to be really interesting, I think, to see what, once touring comes back and once the world sort of gets back on track, how this all changes. Because, you know, I mean, I guess people were doing live streams a bit here and there before COVID, but in this last year, seeing how people have tried to figure out ways to monetize live streams and all that sort of stuff, I haven't really followed all that stuff too closely because, you know, we haven't done much of it. And it's, you know, like I said, it's like our business is different than that, And so I don't know how successful or not successful that's been for people.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see whether or not the steps musicians had to take during this time period to just survive, how much of that will continue afterwards, because it actually turns out to have been an innovation that is useful and not simply a survival technique during the pandemic.
Well, certainly on the promotional side, I think it's probably never going to go back to what it was, because now, you know, we just put it, like I said, we just put out this Foo Fighter record. You know, normally a promo tour for a band like us involves getting on planes every day and flying to new cities and sitting in hotel rooms and doing press junkets and going to radio stations and playing on TV show and all that stuff. And we just did all that from home. So we're still going to go make appearances, obviously, you know, you're still going to do that. You're still going to go on tour, but I would imagine it'll be some sort of hybrid moving forward. But, you know, for musicians, it's become harder and harder over the years to make a living at all. And really the last sort of only way for most people, I think, to make a living is by going out and playing shows. And that's the thing that's been taken away during this time. So with the way that people don't buy records anymore and everything switching over to streaming services and the whole subscription model, which is really good for consumers, of course, it's really tough on musicians.
Chris, you know, I just want to say I was really impressed when you reached out a while back and we talked and you said, look, I'm a SAG-AFTRA member. I've had great success in my life. I want to really help make a difference, which I found to be incredible. To have people really speak out, really to be able to reach out to say, I have the ability to have influence. I want to do it in a positive way. Use me, let me know. Can you just talk, when did you become a SAG-AFTRA member? When did you realize your relationship to union? When, you know, what got you there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember exactly when I joined. It was after when I joined. It was before the merger. So it would have been probably not too long after I joined Foo Fighters, you know, with maybe a couple of years into being in the Foo Fighters. You know, I've always been like pretty progressive or liberal, however you want to define it, and very much pro labor, you know. I think even before, you know, when I was a kid, my mom was a probation officer and she was in the county employees union or whatever it was called at the time. And I remember sort of connecting the dots with how that connected to us having health insurance and how that connected to her being able to get a decent home loan at the credit union and things like that. And just the sort of the day-to-day importance, you know, I was born around in 71. And if you, basically my lifetime is like the organized labor contracting year after year for a very long time. And it's for me, I just wanted to get more involved in a more concrete way and try to figure it out and try to really meet some people in Southern California organized labor world and see where I could slot in. Cause it's just, you know, I feel like we have a good opportunity right now with this new administration to try to hold them to account, you know, and try to get them to fulfill some promises. And it seems like things are off to a pretty good start. And it just seems like a good time to try to be a rabble rouser, you know, in whatever way I can.
I said it to you before, so I'll say it out loud in front of everybody here, but you have a great energy about you. Clearly, it doesn't matter that you didn't finish high school. You're very bright and you make a difference. And so you're kind of the full Monty.
Oh, thank you. You're very sweet. And I love being on your guys' podcast. It was really fun talking to you guys about all this stuff.
Thank you so much for being with us. We look forward to future work together.
Absolutely.
And to listening to good music.
That's right. Listening to good
music. Indeed. Indeed. Yeah. I'll see you guys out there on the picket line.
Yeah.
From the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
Welcome to America Works, interviews with contemporary workers throughout the United States collected by the Library's American Folklife Center as part of its Occupational Folklife Project.
This is AFC's folklorist Nancy Gross, and this America Works podcast features excerpts from a longer interview with Mike Peabody, the program coordinator at the Additional Recyclables Collection Center for the Central Vermont Waste Management District in Montpelier, Vermont. He was interviewed by Archie Green fellow Virginia Nickerson as part of her oral history project, Trash Talk, Workers in Vermont's Waste Management Industry. This interview project documented the work experiences of the men and women who collect garbage and recycle trash throughout the Green Mountain State. Peabody talks about how he learned his trade, working with hard-to-recycle materials, and why he's proud to be a garbage man.
We moved here from my in-law's basement about 80 miles north of here, and I needed a job, and pretty much all I'd had up to that point was farm work, which is not a resume fluffer. So I noticed that there was like a weekend attendant, I think, at the Berry facility, and I fell into that position. It's very much OJT, on-the-job training, right? So you can have a pretty good idea of what is garbage and what is recyclable or what is hazardous waste. And also, I started getting very clear on state regulations about what's banned from disposal, things like televisions and household chemicals and certain batteries. And so I started getting an eye for those things coming in the door. I know I made a couple of people very mad because I refused to take things that I knew were not acceptable. Stuff like 50-gallon bags completely full of liquid paint. Just someone's just trying to convince me, oh, no, it's just trash from my house. Like, really? Like, that's an everyday thing for you is just eating paint with your hands, right? Come on, straighten me out. There are a few hard-to-recycle centers in the country. Yeah, they all do very similar things. There's actually a small but strong undercurrent for recycling really weird stuff. And not like methyl mercury or anything like that, although I guess there's some recovery on that too. But, you know, things that like you just don't think about, oh, can I recycle it all the time? Like crayons or potato chip bags or household stain paints, those kinds of things. And generally speaking, if you can get enough volume of something, you can usually get a truck or a recycler or a processor or a buyer interested in dealing with it. There's a lot of talking to customers and consumers and businesses who want to deal with waste or have an idea about wanting to green their image or just being really frustrated that they have this one waste stream that they know can be recycled, but for whatever reason, because of an economy scale hurdle or a lack of proper equipment or not knowing who will take it where and when, they just can't get it to where it needs to go. About 25% of what we take right now is what the state refers to as covered electronic devices. That's computers and TVs. Yeah, and we're doing about 450,000 to 500,000 pounds a year, which, you know, in the bigger scale of recycling isn't that much. But, you know, for Central Vermont, 500,000 pounds is decent output. I'd say like the big ones are books. We get a lot of books and computers and TVs. Below that, textiles, tires, we get scrap metal or household appliances like vacuums and microwaves that we do often process or send to specialty electronics handlers. And what the district tries to do is divert as much as we can from landfilling. Believe it or not, my work day is pretty typical. It's, you know, generally the same thing. I show up, I look around the building to make sure that no one like threw a pile of tires or a broken TV or something around, because it does happen that people just leave stuff with us. Sometimes it's kind of benign, like just like a sack of like Legos or something. People just don't know what to do with it. They heard that we quote unquote take everything, and so when they show up and we're not open, or they come by at midnight, because I guess they expect it to be there at midnight, they just leave the bag. At our offices the next town over in Montpelier, someone dumped, I want to say, about 40 pounds of potassium nitrate on our front step. And there was just like a note taped to the box that said, like, found this while digging fences, heard you guys took dangerous stuff. Like, I mean, we almost called them the bomb squad. Like, we just didn't know what to do with it. Like, it's not safe to handle, especially once it's been wetted like that. The person who brought it to us didn't do any kind of research or packaging. They just probably threw it in their truck and was like, oh, I should leave a note. That'd be the polite thing to do. A lot of what we do is kind of pickup work for a packaging and manufacturing industry that is sort of moving with the blinders on. Like, so much of what we take right now is just big glass TVs. And nobody at any point during television manufacture in the last 60 years was like, it's a giant glass ball full of lead pumped full of about 20,000 volts of electricity. Meh, someone else's problem. I guess I don't need to think seriously at all about how to properly manage or deal with the downstream on this. Like, downstream is such a modern word. Like, really, before that, at no point was anybody thinking seriously, like, no, because once it's not working anymore, it goes in a hole in the ground, and once 50 million people decide that it doesn't work anymore, they're all going to go into 50 million holes in the ground.
This is folklorist Nancy Gross. Thank you for listening to America Works.
This has been a presentation of the Library of Congress. Visit us at loc.gov.
That's it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, a roundup of highlights from just a few of the more than 100 labor radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. You can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited this week by Patrick Dixon, Chris Banger Drowns, and myself. I produce the show, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LaborRadioNet. Find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. We hope you enjoy the show, and we also hope it inspires you to explore the shows in the Labor Radio Podcast Network. More than 100 across the country and around the world. Ordinary folks who are working hard to air the voices of workers. If you do, please help spread the word about this amazing and growing world of labor radio and podcast shows. Like the show and share it on social media, Sonic Solidarity, if you like. Thanks very much. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show.